If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host. And today we have Brian Christie with us. Brian is an author, a journalist, and a filmmaker. He's written a fictional espionage thriller entitled In the Company of Killers. But he's also the author of a nonfiction book called The Lizard King, which takes a really fascinating deep dive into reptile trafficking in the United States. He founded National Geographic's first investigations unit that looked into wildlife crime, and he's a National Geographic Society Rolex Explorer of the Year. Brian Christie, thanks for being on the show. Welcome to Nature Secret Service.
Thanks for having me.
You and I have known each other for a few years, and I have to say I'm very jealous of your National Geographic Society Explorer of the Year. I've always wanted to be an Nat Geo Explorer, but I don't know how to do it.
I mean, really, you don't have to do anything. You just go out and, follow your passion. And, I'm very privileged to be in that group, because there's some extraordinary people, doing, cutting edge, every aspect of exploration. They've got somebody doing something extraordinary, and I don't know how I got in there.
It's very cool. I do a lot of exploring, Brian. I'm just waiting for him to call me.
They don't call. They don't call. When you make your next big discovery, let me know and I will pass a message on. Let's do that.
Okay. That sounds fair. I'll kind of keep a notebook of my various adventures and discoveries, and you'll be my in. That sounds good.
All right.
Hey, I'm so glad you're willing to come on the podcast, because I have read The Lizard King actually multiple times, because you do such a great job of kind of capturing not just kind of the history of reptile trafficking in the U.S. You kind of start at the beginning of the book telling a little bit of the background on why reptiles are so popular in the U.S., why they're kind of a consistently popular exotic pet. But you also really dive into kind of the mindset of the people who get involved in wild animal legal and illegal trade, which I found just so fascinating as a investigator who used to chase these people. It's really interesting to get into that. And you know, the one thing I've always wanted to ask you is, how did you even ever become aware of this story that you tell in The Lizard King? And, can you just kind of run us through, tell us a little bit about the history of reptile collecting and ownership and selling and buying in the States?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, to me, I think to stick with your first point, it's really about collecting, and I'm really attracted to the collecting obsession, whether it's reptiles or coins. I did a story on the smuggling of the world's most valuable coin, and that really primed me for looking into wildlife trafficking, because it's really a lot of the same motivations, whether it's coins or stamps or wine or painting or wildlife. People, one of the primary motivations is knowledge. Once you get to know something about a species, there are, for certain people, a desire to possess that thing. And that's the same with coins or stamps or things. And the thing about reptiles is you can hold them, and they're cold-blooded, so you can store them in very limited space. And so people are collecting them the way you collect coins, and they're putting them in shelving units that look like something you might store maps or manuscripts in. And so that was one of the things that attracted me right off the bat. I had just done a story for Playboy magazine on coin collecting, this coin smuggling case. And it was the rarest coin on earth, and there was supposed to only be one of them. Sotheby's sold it for a record amount, and I found another one the next day. I started looking into it. And so they said to me, you know, if you could do anything next, what would you do? And I've always loved reptiles. I had reptiles as a boy, and I'd heard about this new then thing called designer breeding. So I wanted to do a story about designer breeding. And they said, well, we're not really interested in that. We want crime stories. And I said, well, hell, there's crime.
Ah, interesting.
It was a young editor. I said, there's crime in this for sure. And I had vague memories of names like Tommy Crutchfield and Hank Molt from when I was buying reptiles in college. And they said, well, tell us about the crime stories. And I was driving at the time. I said, you know, we have a bad connection. And I hung up the phone, and I was in Florida. I drove to the courthouse in Orlando and started looking up reptile crime cases. And case after case had as a defendant a reference to a company called Strictly Reptiles. And case after case had reference to a fish and wildlife agent named Charles Bepler. And I drove down Florida from courthouse to courthouse looking at the original files, having them pull files. And that became true as I proceeded down all the way to Miami. And by the time I got to Miami, I decided that this was something I really wanted to look into. So that was the start.
Very cool, because, you know, the names you mentioned, you know, Crutchfield, Strictly Reptiles, Hank Molt, those are kind of infamous names within the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Law Enforcement. Every agent either does know or should know those names. You talk about Charles Bepler. He went by Chip in the service, had a great reputation as an agent. And I love the way you get into not only, you know, his motives and his drivers, but also how those motives and drivers compared and related to his main nemesis, which was the people who ran Strictly Reptiles. Who were those guys? Tell us a little bit about those people.
Yeah, I mean, the book is, I set up basically as a cat and mouse story between Chip Bepler, the fish and wildlife agent, and his nemesis, Mike Van Nostrand, who runs Strictly Reptiles. Strictly Reptiles is the largest reptile wholesale company on earth. They are bringing in 50% of the green iguanas you see in pet shops around the country. Back in the 90s came from that single place. They're bringing in every reptile that's available legally, and as it would turn out, some amazing illegal animals as well. And they're Chip and Mike were really wonderful to focus on as a cat and mouse, because they were opposites in every way. Chip was a tall, thin, relatively thin, he's 6'4", thin guy, very soft-spoken, very polite. Comes from a family, all his siblings have master's degrees or PhDs. His father was a doctor, went to Princeton, served in the Korean War. Everything about him was upper crust, and Chip was motivated by loved animals. He had an affection for animals that said, I'm not going to follow the path my family's, you know, this advanced degree college. He has a sister who's a PhD in chemistry. I'm not doing that route. I want to be out with the animals I care about. So contrast that with Mike Van Nostrand, who weighs 352 pounds. He's loud. He drives a jacked up F-250 truck that he can't get in. He can barely get into. It has a horn that he has doctored. It's a train horn. It's illegal. And he likes to drive through the prominent neighborhoods in South Florida. He lives in Davie, and blow the horn while people are eating out in outdoor restaurants. Just for no reason. I spent years with Mike. I was shot in the head with paper clips regularly. He threw, 100-pound python on me when I wasn't looking. He had me cleaning the cages of bird-eating tarantulas that are, as you may know, they have these hairs that they use as a defense that mm-hmm. they sort of brush off nictitating hairs that get in your eyes and your skin can cause can put you in the hospital. So those are two very different characters. Mike's dad was not only an amazing reptile dealer, but he was also ran drugs and guns in South Florida at a time when it was a very violent thing to do. So those two characters, to bring them together in a story, was just too good to be true for me.
Yeah, it was tailor-made. Definitely tailor-made. Tell us about, give us a sense of the scope of Mike Van Nostrand and Strictly Reptiles business. And not only their legal business, but the illegal business too. Why was Chip Bepler interested in Strictly Reptiles?
So Chip started out with Fish and Wildlife as an inspector, and then moved to Office of Law Enforcement, working out of JFK. And he, in New York, was making wildlife cases, case after case, putting them together. And then his boss, Sam LeBrandi, said, Chip, I really appreciate your effort and your industry and things, but we're not going to be able to prosecute any of these people. And Chip was, what do you mean? And our cases go to major crimes at the prosecutor's office, and they're prosecuting Gotti right now. So you've got this Pine Barrens tree frog case you want to bring, or this barn owl case you want to bring. I'm not going to call them up. I can't. And Chip said, well, screw it. I'm calling them. And he did on a barn owl case. And Sam told me the story, Chip held the phone away from his head. The prosecutor was yelling at him. So violently that how are you kidding me that you're bringing you want to bring an owl case when we've got Gotti we're going after. So but what Chip saw in Sam moved him to reptiles because a lot of reptiles were coming through JFK. And what Chip saw was a lot of these reptiles were destined for this company in South Florida called Strictly Reptiles. And that kind of put a bee in his bonnet for what's going on with Strictly. And as you know very well, reptiles, is a very above board business. There's very honest keepers and pet shops and breeders and things all around the world. But when reptiles go dishonest, they go hard, and they're very clever. Yep. The traders, it's high volume. In some cases, it's very high value. In other cases, the great thing about smuggling reptiles is they're small. They're cold blooded, so they can go for long periods of time without water. If you cool them down, you can stuff them into things. You can stuff them into poison arrow frogs into a matchbox. And they do. And Chip wanted to go after this wholesaler in Florida that appeared to be a major driver for reptiles. And from what he was hearing, a lot of smugglers in Florida for lots of species were keying off the success of Strictly. Like, if Strictly's getting away with this on reptiles, so I can do it for birds. Strictly's getting away with it on reptiles, so I can do it for primates. And that was happening down there.
Right.
So he and his wife, Robin Bepler, was a wildlife inspector. They moved to South Florida in large part motivated by Chip's desire to go after this guy, Strictly Reptiles. And it turns out they bought a rancher, a small house, kind of down the street from Strictly Reptiles in Hollywood. And for Chip to get to the office in Miami, he had to drive past Mike's warehouse. And Mike's warehouse is a former Frito-Lay warehouse. So it's got multiple loading docks. It's surrounded in barbed wire, in chain link fence, topped with barbed wire. There are cameras. It's basically half a city block devoted to moving legal and moving reptiles. And some exotic mammals and stuff. So Chip had to drive past. It was very much sheepdog and coyote to me. when I went down there the first time, you know, so I'm reading all these case files, and I decide I'm going to go to Strictly and see what it's like. And Strictly's on a Sterling Road in Hollywood, and it's not quite a highway, but it moves very quickly, and there's no way to slow down to get a look into the parking lot. And so I had to keep making these drive-by passes that were the same passes Chip drove to work, but I had to keep going back and forth just to kind of put together a picture of what the parking lot looked like, let alone what it looked like inside.
Would have been a hard place to do surveillance.
That's really where I'm going. I was like, I forget what's across the street, but I couldn't. I wanted to kind of set up. This was my first or kind of my second big investigation. It was my first real, like, freewheeling. I'm going to do it. My uncle, my godfather was one of the pioneer FBI undercovers, and he was mentoring me at this time, at this point, kind of giving me advice and things. And I wanted to do that kind of setup and watch, and there was no time for that. So I did what he later told me was the stupidest. He used a lot of profanity but my first time confronting the Van Nostrands, I have a problem that I look like a cop to people. Particularly if I'm asking questions as a journalist, you know, and they're criminal. So I came up with this plan that I went to Subway, which was just down the street, and bought a sandwich with everything on it. Just what do you want? I want lettuce, tomato, mayonnaise, oil and vinegar, everything. And I drove to Strictly, and then I drove into the parking lot, and a bunch of the employees were standing on the loading dock. And I got out of my truck and dumped the sandwich down my shirt as I was taking a bite of it. And they all saw me do it, and they looked at me, and they thought I might be many things, but none of them thought I was a cop. And I used
that's pretty good, Brian.
Yeah, I was pretty. So I was very proud of myself. I was like, you know, I broke it with humor. Everybody's kind of like, "Hey, asshole, what are you? You know, what are you doing here?" and stuff. And so I told my uncle this after the fact, and he said, "What you did? What? Are you stupid? That's the stupidest effing thing I've ever heard. You have a great story, and this was a great lesson for me." You just did a story for Playboy. Playboy told you they want a story. Tell these guys you're there from Playboy. You've had reptiles.
Exactly.
You had reptiles as a boy. You know about them. You care about them. Tell them the truth. I said, the whole truth that I'm there. No, not the whole truth, you idiot. So this was kind of me getting off the ground. So I did. I went in the next day. Mike wasn't there the first day anyway. And I went there the next day and I said, I'm from Playboy. And he and his father, Ray, who was kind of the kingpin, if you want to, it's hard for me to stand outside. I know the family so well, it's hard for me to stand outside. But Ray sort of started everything. Ray yeah. said, you're from Playboy? And Ray has a shaved head and gold chains. And I said, yep. And he got on the phone and I was concerned he was calling for backup or he was calling for somebody to check out my bona fides or something. And the next thing I know, Ray's girlfriend showed up and she said, you're from Playboy? And I said, yes. And she unbuttoned her top and said, do you think I can get in the magazine? So that was my day one. Classic. Day one on my investigation.
Yeah. That's a perfect juxtaposition to who Chip Bepler was. That's perfect. You mentioned in that explanation that, you know, Strictly Reptiles was coming up all the time in Chip's other investigations. And to give listeners a sense of the scope of these businesses, you know, your book describes how Strictly Reptiles was supplying, it was the major supplier of many, many reptiles all across the United States, but particularly on the East Coast, and was doing well over $1 million in business every year. And the warehouse you described really triggers memories for me of all of the warehouses near Los Angeles International Airport that primarily deal with fish, but they're huge. I mean, these are many tens of thousands of square feet warehouses filled with row upon row of interconnected aquariums that do nothing but 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, process live animals for the pet trade. And those big warehouses for reptile and the reptile importers and exporters, they're exactly the same. It's a huge business, and the Van Nostrands and Strictly were neck deep in it and making a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they made, I don't know how many millions they were making a year at their peak, but getting ahead of the story, when Mike's first year working with his dad, after his dad got out of prison, they made $1 million. So they were really the gorilla on the block. LA Reptiles was their major competitor. And I don't know how the country sort of split up in terms of what species went where, but that the only competitor they had at during these years was LA Reptiles.
Yeah. A lot of that depends on shipping routes and who has the best access to shipping routes and the cheapest shipping routes. So tell us about what was the first time Chip encountered Mike Van Nostrand? How did that come about that Chip started an investigation? What was their first encounter like?
There was an agent in the Miami office named Jennifer English, and Jennifer was kind of Chip's walk Chip through what Miami was going to be like. And early on, when Chip got to Miami, they got a call that a guy, an Argentine green card holder from Argentina, had been stopped at Miami International with a suitcase of what turned out to be turtles in socks, and he had hundreds of these things sewed into strips inside a suitcase. And this was going to be Jennifer's idea was, I'm going to introduce Chip to this no-brainer smuggler that's not going to go anywhere. None of these cases ever go anywhere. And it turned out that this guy was carrying a black book that connected him to a major operation in South Florida called Pet Farm, which was at that point operating as a flow-through shell for Strictly. So Mike was, Van Nostrand was writing checks to a guy at Pet Farm named Dale Morantz, and Dale Morantz was writing checks to or paying this courier named Thomas Medina. And Bepler flipped Medina off the bat. So right off the bat, you had he turned a nothing case into a lead on the biggest operator in the world, reptiles-wise. And so a guy that from state game named John West brought Chip to Strictly and introduced him to Mike. And and Chip said, hey, we've I think it was Mike who said, I heard one of my customers or suppliers you recently arrested. And I was really surprised, Mike said, because I thought all his stuff was captive bred. And Chip said, now, why would you say that out of the blue? Well, you know, and I can hear Mike backpedaling with this kind of you cannot stump Mike for an answer. He, whether he's right or wrong in what he says, he will have an answer immediately. And he says, you know, I owe him money for this last shipment. He's probably going to need a lawyer and he probably wants to get paid. So he reached out to me and he says, as Bepler's leaving, you know, am I under investigation? Because I think you have to tell me if I am. And Bepler said, you're not under formal investigation, but I can't tell you I won't be back. And that's out of a movie right there. And of course he is back, and he's back again and often, as they say. And
hard
step by step. Yeah,
One of the greatest things I love about that description in the book of that encounter between Chip, that first encounter between Chip and Mike, is that when Chip leaves, you know, Mike kind of thinks this agent's an idiot. He should have done what's called a controlled delivery, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And, you know, this is what's kind of to back up for some of my listeners who aren't in law enforcement. It's pretty common that you catch what we call a mule at the airport or somewhere else crossing a land border. That's just, they're called a mule because they're basically carrying contraband, wildlife, drugs, whatever, for somebody higher up in the criminal enterprise. And so there's a couple ways you can deal with it. You can bust that person right there and do what Chip did and interview them and see if they'll become a cooperator. Or you can, if you do it right, you can let them go and they actually never know that you know that they're smuggling wildlife. And then you do a surveillance on that person and see where they go next. And wherever they deliver the product, then you do a search warrant. That's called a controlled delivery. But the thing I love about this is both techniques are totally legit. And you described how Chip successfully flipped Medina, turned him into a cooperator. But when Chip left that meeting with Van Osteren, Mike's thinking, this Chip's an idiot because he didn't do a controlled delivery on my place, right? Little did he know that Chip had a plan.
He did have a plan, and he also had and if you're not in law enforcement, you might miss this. And I'm only really realizing it as we're talking about it. By coincidence, America's Most Wanted, that TV show, was at the airport. They were doing a project on bird smuggling with Jennifer English, so Jennifer brought them to the airport to film. This is why I could tell the story so accurately and in such detail. There were cameras on Medina. So it now occurs to me that Chip might have been concerned that a controlled delivery wouldn't have worked if it aired on not knowing when it might air on television. Then if you're trying to break up a controlled delivery downstream, that could blow that. So he had a couple of things he had to think about, in that first intro. Yeah.
It really speaks to, though, to Chip's personality and character, because you know, he was known kind of throughout the service as a person who was able to, I won't say make friends with the people he was investigating. That's the wrong word, but you know, he was able to somehow identify with them and often build some sort of rapport with them. So he was actually pretty good at flipping people and turning them into cooperators, because, you know, bad guys always hate the cops who are chasing them. But at the same time, a lot of the guys who Chip was chasing couldn't hate him. Like they hated him, but they also liked him. You know what I mean?
I heard that from Mike again and again, and from a bunch of people that, and to be honest, I took a lesson from that. You know, because particularly when you're in the wildlife space, as a journalist, you're supposed to hate anybody dealing in wildlife, anybody moving wildlife or profiting from wildlife. And I've taken a lot of heat, or some heat, over the years from people who think in black and white and want to treat people in black and white. And if you do that, you can feel good about yourself at the end of the day, but you don't move the ball forward as anywhere near as far as you can. And that was a lesson I learned from people talking about Chip, and I integrated into my own approach. And my uncle, the FBI undercover, was also very adamant about not being judgmental. And he compares undercover to a first date. You know, you do, you do what she wants to do. You like what she wants to like. You know, this is kind of an exaggerated thing, and he might use more graphic language. But it's that kind of dance to an objective that particularly in the wildlife space, is not many people, not enough people understand.
Well, it's an interesting point, because there's another element to it that I think a lot of law enforcement officers have this philosophy, and if they don't, they should. I got really great advice before I became a federal agent. I was a prosecutor for a while, and I got really great advice from then Attorney General of the state of Washington, Christine Gregoire. She used to tell all of the prosecutors in the AG's office never to forget that you still work for the people you're prosecuting. Like, as a public servant, you work for the people you're actually chasing. And so with that comes certain responsibilities, like protecting their constitutional rights, treating them with dignity. Yes, they are your foe in terms of trying to enforce the law, but they're not your enemy. They are, you are a law enforcer. Yeah, you're a law enforcer attempting to bring consequences to people who need it. And these people, you know, they're still individuals who have rights and need to be treated decently. So I had a similar experience with Chip. A lot of people that I investigated for years later arrested who, yeah, they didn't like me, but yet they would still wave at me when they saw me in court. They would wave and smile because I treated them decently, you know?
Yeah,
interesting phenomenon.
Yeah. I mean, at Nat Geo, I would get people, you know, editors would say, how could you possibly know that? Why did he tell you this? I'm talking about other smuggling stories I worked on. And my answer in general was because that he liked me, you know, because I listened and spent the time. And most of the time when I would get an assignment, they would say, what do you need? And my number one answer would be time. It's not so much about money. It's not so much about, expenses or that kind of thing. It just give me time. And that's, as an undercover and as an investigator, you know, that's kind of to build that sort of rapport and get past your own, in my case, you know, some of your own prejudices, takes time too.
It's the same. It's the same whether it's an undercover or an overt investigation, because that in that overt investigation, if you can't build rapport with the people you're going out and interviewing, they're not going to give you any information. Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of inherent in the, you know what, we'll just say inherent in the investigator world, whether it's an investigative journalist or an investigator in a law enforcement setting.
Yeah.
There's certain behaviors that garner better results. And back to how Chip was handling this, one of the things I find so interesting among criminals, bad guys, is that here Chip visits Mike Van Ostrand with a state officer in uniform. Mike definitely knows now that one of his couriers has been busted, right? He's got to know that he might think Chip's a dummy, but he's not a complete dummy. And Chip's going to continue to investigate. And yet Mike and Strictly Reptile continue to engage in illegal activity. After that first meeting, like, what were some of the things Strictly Reptile and Mike were involved in? What kind of illegal reptile business were they doing?
He had a don't ask, don't tell philosophy. So he had guys, to back up, you know, Mike inherited this business from his dad. His dad was a true reptile, world-class expert, but he was also, came up at a time when Miami was a drug trafficking center and gun trafficking center, and the kind of same rush you get from dealing in cobras you get. And so he was doing all of that. Mike wanted to be an accountant and had gone to Broward Community College to be an accountant. He hated the drug dealer types that showed up at the family's house. And his dad gets arrested in a major case called Operation Cobra that involves Mario Tabrawi, which is a big name in the DEA and fish and wildlife world, of course. And Ray rolls on Mario and goes to prison. He's in Witsec out in Arizona. And Mike quits his dream path to support his mom and brother and things. So he comes into the business with very genuine, really admirable goals. That I'm going to take responsibility for the family. But he is just a giant child in a way. He just can't avoid the thrill of getting away with something. So he's got guys suitcasing stuff up from Central America. And the thing that he loves is just them opening the suitcase. Like, he can't believe Phil Langston, who's supposed to be a CIA connected guy, has stuffed so many lizards and snakes into a single suitcase. He just that kind of opening the box, you know, there people dig box opening videos on TikTok and stuff. That's Mike sitting there. What do you got? So he's got those kinds of things. He's got suppliers. Firma Hasco is the largest. You know, if you think about this as a syndicate, the major operators are Mike in the United States, Firma Hasco operating out of Indonesia, Anson Wong, and Sungai Rusa Wildlife, who's using a zoo as a cover in Malaysia. And Anson is considered the Pablo Escobar of wildlife trafficking. He's moving snow leopard pelts and panda bear skins and elephants out of Thailand. He can get you Spix's macaws.
Right.
But reptiles are his thing. And Anson is Mike's supplier for that part. So these guys all know each other and are operating. So Mike is moving product from those guys, Indian star tortoises, plowshare tortoises are something that Anson is moving at the time. Fiji Island iguanas, all the, you know, to non-reptile people, they don't really mean anything, but These are all the, you know, the gold level species for those who have the addiction. And that's what's going on in the consumer end of this, is there are people, they're really addicted to, I've got to have the next shiny thing. And that's what we're dealing with.
And you mentioned like Fiji Island iguanas, and, you know, I know Anson Wong, I believe was also involved in Komodo dragons, I believe. Some of these guys, I think it was Anson Wong who tried to smuggle some Komodo dragons that ended up going to the LA Zoo. And then when they grew up, they later bit the toe of the husband of Sharon Stone. That's another story. I'll let listeners read your book to get that story. that's one of the famous stories that goes around the LA field office, is the, cause those Komodo dragons at the LA Zoo came from a law enforcement case, they were seized, and now they're big, gigantic, ferocious dragons. But you know, in naming some of these species, some of the species you mentioned are some of the most endangered reptiles in the world, and hard to get. And I think some listeners will say, well, wait a second. There's a legal trade for reptiles, right? There's a big legal trade. We see reptiles at Petco, pet shops all the time. Why go to all the trouble of suitcasing in exotics? And can you explain a little bit about that? Like, why aren't all these things legal? Why are people going to the trouble of smuggling reptiles when there is a legal trade in many species?
Because not all species are alike to collectors. It'd be like saying to a coin collector, hey, you've got a whole drawer full of pocket change. Why do you need a 1933 double eagle gold piece? You know,
exactly.
But these are the guys who have the 1929, the 1930, the 1930D, the 1930P, you know, that's this level of high end. When you're talking about the kind of boutique level species, and then there are some,
and that's where the money is too.
That's right. but there's also the making, you know, making a species illegal to trade gives a monopoly to the people who are willing to break the law and trade in that species. So the animal might not be rare, but because the country prohibits its exportation, it's hard to get, and only lawbreakers can get it for you. And that can cut. I mean, it's not always the law that's kind of right. If you, for example, you can walk into PetSmart, you mentioned PetSmart, you can walk into PetSmart today and you'll see bearded dragons, maybe the most popular, among the most popular reptiles and most appropriate pet reptiles there is. Well, those are from Australia, and it's illegal to get them out. But some Germans did, among others, years ago, and they're easy to breed. And as a result, there are bearded dragons everywhere, and nobody is going to fly over to Australia and stuff them in their underwear and carry them out of Australia. So, but the original guys, the reason they're out there is because they were illegal to trade in. And so guys were willing to take the risk for the money to get those original ones out.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you make, you know, because I think generally speaking, we don't walk around thinking about it, but a lot of these species that are common in the pet trade now and completely legal were once, if you go far enough down their lineage, probably the originals were smuggled out of somewhere illegally. It happens.
Yeah,
and that is a goal of a lot of these smugglers is to get, they want to get like a Fiji Island iguana, which is very endangered. They want to get it to the States and they want to breed it. And once they can breed it, then they can start to create this gray area where they're basically hiding an illegal animal and claiming it was captive raised. And in many instances, CITES has exceptions for captive raised animals. And that was one of the next question I was going to ask you is, did Strictly and Mike Van Ostrin, did they know the CITES rules and did they take advantage of loopholes like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mike in particular was very adept at, when I say, I'm always underscoring that Mike's not a reptile guy. He's really a business right. guy that reptiles just happen to be the commodity he's moving. But for him, it's all about the paperwork. He is moving. So when Bepler would come in and say, I'm taking those tortoises, they're illegal. Mike would physically say, no, you're not taking them, and go ahead and try. And there was a physical tug of war at one point. And Mike was resolute in his position because he knew he had paid off the appropriate Indian official to doctor the paperwork so that the paperwork was legitimate. And Mike believed if the paperwork is legitimate, I win. So people are always talking about CITES paperwork being doctored and captive bred, which is a loophole. If you've bred it in captivity, you can often trade in species that are otherwise illegal to move. But Mike really took it to another level where it was all about, it didn't matter if he bribed somebody to do that paperwork. If the paperwork had the right signature and the right boxes checked, he really did believe he was right legally.
It's funny because in some ways he's not wrong, because it takes a very, very good investigator to uncover the basis for that fraud. It's not easy because you often have to get information from foreign countries. I worked on many cases like that where people doctored paperwork, and it becomes a totally different case and requires a whole different level of professional investigative skills. So in some ways, Mike wasn't wrong. He was much more likely to get away with it if the paperwork just looked right.
Yeah. And there's, a lot of these UAE was a country that they were moving some things through. West Africa the level of corruption in these countries, I mean, so institutionalized, you almost can't call it corruption. On an ivory story, I was working with some wildlife officers in East Africa, and they were explaining to me how we were talking about corruption. And he said, well, my family has this many people in it, and I'm expected, because I have a good government job, I am expected to deliver a certain amount of money to my family members, and quite distant from my perspective, family members. And so from the perspective of my family, if I'm not stealing, I'm doing something wrong. And he told it in third person terms. He said, if they're not stealing, they're doing something wrong. But then at the end, he said, even me. And, it's easy to say, oh, you shouldn't do that. But then you ask, what's your monthly salary? And it is, the salary that wildlife officers get in some of these countries, it's just dollars a month. It's so bad. And these guys are, one elephant tusk can carry these guys for months. And that was the same in the Philippines. I had a guy that was willing to work with me in the Philippines on a project. But his government salary didn't allow him ink for his fax machine. He wanted to share with me something and he couldn't. So I sent him cartridges of ink. And that was the only ink his office had. And that sort of thing is something people, it's really hard to, I felt really incredibly entitled and privileged to be coming over on my soapbox many times saying, you know, I'm investigating wildlife crime and seeing the circumstances that the people on both sides of the law were in. It's very humbling.
Yeah, I've had many conversations myself with foreign law enforcement officers about corruption and the drivers, and sometimes the answers are very, sobering and hard to, hard to preach against necessarily when they tell you their situations. How did Chip finally make a case against Mike Van Ostrand and Strictly?
Well, it turns out, and this is like, you know, this story seemed magical in very extraordinary ways, both good and tragic in ways as well. But Chip is kind of the guys in the team in the Miami office gave him said, look, you want to go after Strictly? It's full time. It's going to be a full time operation. We will take over your extra cases and enable you to go after Strictly. They gave him a separate room. They called the Bat Cave, and he was full time on Strictly. Unbeknownst to him, there was a team in the Netherlands that had seen something called a frilled dragon coming out of Papua New Guinea, Southeast Asia, and with captive born paperwork. Right. They were marking these lizards at the source with a dye that would show up under a black light. And they were tracing these lizards from Indonesia to Holland, and then seeing them go to as captive bred to Strictly. And they
interesting.
I don't remember how they connected. These guys were equally, they were not wildlife guys. They were just like the pioneers in law enforcement on reptiles in many ways. They were made fun of in major crimes for saying we're going to go after frilled dragons instead of mafia guys. They named their team Team Aura, the Latin for the poison arrow frogs that were also coming through.
Dutch police. Yeah, the Dutch police, right?
And they had wiretap
powers
that Chip did not have. And they got a tap as well on the comms between a guy in Indonesia. And when they teamed up together, that helped build the case against Mike.
Interesting. Okay. So finally they somehow connected with Chip, shared information, and that allowed Chip to prove that fraudulent paperwork and that Mike knew he was importing essentially wild frilled dragons. Yeah.
Yeah, Phil Dragon, he had many, yeah, and Chip had several cases in play at the same time. There was a case of 99 star tortoises. He had a number of cases in play, and he was able to, I off the top of my head, I don't remember which case was kind of the nail in the coffin for Van Ostrand, but the frilled dragon case was the lead, as I recall, that ended up being prosecutable.
And the fun thing is, Chip eventually teamed up with a fairly new assistant U.S. attorney in Miami named Tom Watts Fitzgerald, who went on to become fairly famous in his own right for leading the environmental crimes section, or starting and leading the environmental crimes section there in Miami. And he was able to get a successful prosecution on I don't think it was Tom Watts Fitzgerald that prosecuted Strictly, but Chip was able to get a successful prosecution on Strictly and Mike. Oh, it was. Okay, cool.
Yep.
Tom Watts, what was the result?
By wildlife standards, it was small. I think he got 8 months prison time and $250,000 fine, as I recall, and then was kind of knocked out of international trade for a bit. But it knocked Mike back on his heels in a way that altered the direction, I think, of his really of his life. And I say that with some caveats that we might want to get to. And it also sent shockwaves through the reptile world that Strictly had fallen. And when Strictly fell, I believe that had a chilling effect across the reptile world and beyond into the bird world in South Florida. South Florida is a melting pot for wildlife crime of all species. And of course, at the same time, you have Operation Chameleon going down with George Morrison and Ken McLeod, Sam Hola. And that is an operation targeting Anson Wong, who is Mike's major Asian supplier. So those two things wrapped at around the same time in the late 90s. And Anson was a much bigger. Anson gets 5 years. That was a major case, and Mike rolls on Anson, which is quite significant.
And helped his sentence, no doubt. Yeah, that
right. And Chip, because
that would have helped his sentence
because of the rapport Chip built with Mike, that Mike would, think that he could do that in a responsible way.
You mentioned there are three pretty famous agents, Special Agent George Morrison, Special Agent Ken McLeod, and Special Agent Sam Mahola. Those three agents were part of Special Operations Unit, which was part of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And they did take down Anson Wong, which was an amazing coup. And the timing of it, I think, your point is well taken. The timing of that with Strictly was kind of a blow to some of these kind of cowboys who had the Wild West of reptile smuggling for a while there.
Yeah. I mean, just in the same way Operation Renegade, right, took out the bird world, in the early 90s, this was reptiles in the late 90s were the traffic, high dollar, high crime, violence was a part of the trade. It was the major wildlife case for that generation.
You mentioned some caveats, and let's talk about, I think sometimes when we talk about these penalties, some of our listeners or my listeners are like, what? He only got 8 months, one of the worst wildlife traffickers in the country, and they only got 8 months. Tell us about some of those caveats you mentioned, you hinted at, and what do you think about sentences like this in terms of overall deterrence?
Yeah, so I do think it had a major chilling effect. The caveat I have in mind is, Mike said to me without Chip's interdiction, he never would have stopped smuggling. Just like, collectors kind of move from the next rarer thing to be a dealer and moving in more and more rarer and rarer, higher and higher dollar, you're getting into more dangerous territory. So I don't know where Mike's life would have gone if he had not been, had the brakes put on at a time when he had a young family and was forced to kind of reckon with the fact that he had fallen into the similar shoes to the shoes he tried to avoid that were, had been his father's. The sentence itself is, yeah, it was low, from an outsider's perspective. The challenge, one of the challenges that you guys face is, the law requires knowledge, under the Lacey Act. You've got to prove that the smuggler knew, the animals he was moving, were illegal. And that's different from cocaine. You don't have to prove the guy with cocaine in his pocket, knew cocaine was illegal. But you do with wildlife. And so making a case, is very, very difficult.
And it, you know, it's, there's another element to it that's probably worth a whole episode of this podcast all by itself, which is probably coming, honestly, down the road. You know, a lot of what we haven't talked about, but certainly Chip also made charges against Strictly for, you know, things like money laundering, smuggling, Lacey Act, Endangered Species Act, all of those except Endangered Species Act could be felonies, serious felonies. But what it comes down to is when a judge sentences somebody, they refer to what's called the U.S. sentencing guidelines in the federal court. And they are guidelines. They're not mandatory, but most judges follow the guidelines because they want to be consistent with other judges around the country when they sentence. And that, in my opinion, Brian, is the real crux of the problem with low sentences in federal wildlife cases, is that they're guided by the sentencing guidelines, which have a specific section for environmental crimes. And interestingly, I'll bet you didn't even know this. I don't think the sentencing guidelines have been updated for almost 40 years. And so they reflect a different era and a different time in our thinking about how serious wildlife trafficking is. And many of the most serious wildlife trafficking offenses, when you look at them in the sentencing guidelines, some of them come out with the same recommended sentences you would get for vandalizing a outhouse in a national park. So
that's fascinating.
How's that for a yeah, that's something we're going to talk about in more detail on this podcast, because really what needs to happen is the Judicial Commission needs to go back and look at the sentencing guidelines for environmental crimes and change them. They need to be updated.
That's a great idea.
In addition to, you know, there's lots of things CITES could do too to close loopholes and whatnot. There's no avoiding the sad ending to this part of this story. And that is that, shortly after this case went down and Chip was kind of looking for his next case, he was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And what, about 2 years later, he passed away. But yeah, you know, that's a tragic story. It was a huge loss for the service to lose Chip. But I think one of the most poignant parts of The Lizard King is the chapter where you describe Chip's funeral. And there was an unexpected guest at that funeral. Who was that?
It's Mike Van Ostrand. The same Florida game officer, John West, who I think is now Captain John West, is at the funeral. And Mike is not asked to go to the funeral, but he takes it upon himself to show up. And this speaks to the rapport that Chip developed with him. And Mike really respected Chip. I could hear it. I spent years with Mike, and you could hear every story he told, no matter how mad he was or how wrong he thought Pepler was. Every time he had respect for him, and he would sort of footnote that constantly. And so these are, you know, these are all people who love Chip and are going to miss him. They are wildlife officers from across the country, prosecutors that he's interacted with from New York and Florida, of course, Chip's family. And They all know who Mike Van Alstyne is. If you know Chip, you know who Van Alstyne is. And Mike weighs 400 pounds. Right. So he's not, you know, he's not a person who can hide. And, you know, he walks in and counted it for me, you know, most people are saying, what is he doing here? Mike took a seat next to John West and said, you know, do you mind if I sit with you, John? And then as people are standing up to talk about Chip, West elbows him and says, you got to stand up, say something, Mike. And,
wow.
And, it's when I heard that part of the story, I knew I wanted to write this book because, and Mike does, and he stands up and he says, I'm probably the most unique person in this room because I was one of Chip's cases. And, it goes on to talk about what a great father he knew Chip was. They both were into baseball. Mike's a very serious, you know, as a result of getting kind of knocked off the rails of illegal behavior, at least for a while, he gets very involved in Little League. He's a great coach. And Chip was also into sports, and he talked about that and what a positive influence Chip had on his life. So that was a very poignant moment to a very tragic event.
Yeah, I have to say, I think, you know, it speaks volumes for Chip's professionalism and character that he was able to make that impression on somebody else and yet still hold them accountable. You know, it's not as if he let Mike get away with anything. It's not as if he became his pal and looked the other way. He held him accountable, but he still managed to gain that kind of respect, which, you know, I think it's obvious to listeners that Mike is Strictly Reptiles is still in existence. It's not like the Fish and Wildlife Investigation put him out of business, but it clearly had an effect on the person who needed consequences.
I wanted to close the book on a positive note, but there was something in the back of my mind that said, you know, you don't want to vouch for Mike in this story because you don't know what the future is going to hold. And it turns out that just a few years ago, Mike is prosecuted again by Tom Watts Fitzgerald, the same prosecutor that got him with Chip, for smuggling Florida turtles to China and Japan is the allegation. And he is convicted, sentenced again to several months in prison. And I think the fine was $150,000. But he's also barred from the business entirely for a number of years. And so that is the modern update on his story.
That's interesting because, you know, my colleague and I, Aaron Dean, we used to talk a lot about how, you know, to some extent, we'll see some of these guys again. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that because we can't control for that. All we can do is enforce the law as it's written, and we let the courts and the process take their course. And some of these people will be back again and they will need more consequences. And if those jail times go longer and the fines get higher, the more they reoffend. So Brian, thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate it. Everybody go out and get The Lizard King. It's a great book, an easy read, fun read, and you'll learn a lot. Take care. Nature's Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturessecretservice.com.